Welcome to PreventionWeb, Building the Resilience of Nations and Communities to Disasters. We speak with people working in disaster risk reduction in this podcast, People in DRR. This is Sarah Wade-Hutman with PreventionWeb, and I'm having a conversation today with Andiswa Milisa, the Director for Geoinformatics at Umvoto Africa. So Andiswa, can you tell me a little bit about you, where you're from, where you live, and how you got started working with Umvoto?
I'm from the Eastern Cape in South Africa. I grew up in the villages, but I was lucky enough to have an educated family. I did my undergraduate degree with the University of Fort Hare, same university that Mandela went to. Opportunity to work for Umvoto came via my lecturer. I took it, and it's a very small company, but it's not so small anymore because we've got 11 people now. When I started, there were about four of us at some point, so we've grown in the past 4 or 5 years. My main interest in what I've followed was the GIS and remote sensing, but because the company is more, the bread and butter is groundwater exploration and resource management, but we also have an interest in geohazards as we're using structural geology for groundwater evaluation. So my main interest is not in the in all the disasters, but it's the geologically related disasters. Floods, yes, a bit, but more if the floods are caused by structural damage, then I'm quite interested in that. But our involvement has been more academic disasters. We don't actually have yet a project that we've worked in that has involved communities, but we've done booklets for the UN, gender booklets, best practices in Africa and in for disaster risk reduction.
Some of our listeners may not be as familiar as you with geoinformatics and what that is and how it can contribute to disaster risk reduction. Maybe you can speak to that.
GIS first, geographic information systems. Well, in a nutshell, it's just more about telling people where things are. With disaster risk reduction, I think knowing where your infrastructure is, where your population is, how much of that population is. So having a map in front of you that shows you where everything that you might need is very useful, more than having what we were used to in the past, tables and text. So taking all the information that's been written by someone or collected during survey, putting that into a map form or a graphic form that people could actually coordinate with and see that if I'm here, then the next bus would be there for evacuation purposes, that quite helps. Now, if you add the GIS with Earth observation, which is where my main interest is, they're not totally linked. They're not totally separate, but it's two disciplines coming together. Earth observation allows you to actually plan in advance. What interests me the most with Earth observation is you are able to anticipate where the disasters might happen. Vulnerability mapping. It's much easier to do it using Earth observation data and transform your results into GIS data, because not all the time the areas where geohazards could occur is accessible to people. So volcanic areas, for example, it's much easier if you've got an image, a satellite image, to map out where your volcanoes are, prepare the community for evacuation of officers. Using the Earth observation, you are able to map up where your settlements are. Most of the topographic maps that are available, they're in such a scale that villages are only a point in a map. But with Earth observation, you are actually able to map up where those households are, and you can actually estimate even the number of people that occupy those pieces of land. And also, because the topographic maps available are outdated, I mean, some of them go back to like 20 years, and the surveys in the countries, especially in Africa, haven't been updating the data. Earth observation allows us to do things like that, because there's people settling in all sorts of places that if you're just looking at a topographic map of an area, you don't see that. So for the planning of knowing how many people or where your people are situated in relation to a possible disaster or eruption of a volcano in this case, you can use that. And also using digital elevation models, you are able to estimate the lava flow and which areas would actually be affected by that, and therefore prepare those communities for evacuation. So most the earth observation side mainly comes on the preparation side, preparing your communities, and also on the monitoring side, because during and after the disaster, if you're capturing the images, and some of the satellites we've got, they've like 14 days in between. Others, you can prompt them that for this duration, I want you to capture the images every day over a certain area or orbit for you to update. And so you can even see in cases of flooding, you can see how your flood is progressing and how the people are being evacuated are moving. So they're quite useful tools together, the GIS and remote sensing. Then you take all the data you've collected with Earth observation and you move it into your GIS system, which then when you're disseminating the information after the effect to aid you can use that.
Can you speak to the point of information dissemination? There must be many challenges there, and I presume that a lot of partnership and collaboration is required, particularly at the community level.
Well, I think the first part, the first challenge with information dissemination is knowing who the people you're talking to are. Knowing your audience, the first, what are they capable of understanding? And because if your audience is school children, for example, different context on how you present the data. If your audience is people who don't work or haven't gone to school, they stay in the villages, they cannot read, for example. That means if you give them pamphlet, it's useless. They don't know that. But also, learning the language that each community uses also helps. Some of the villages we've got, they're more into music. They understand music better. So trying to put some of the information into song and dance and drama helps people to understand that more. But other communities are more technical. If you go to most of suburbia areas, it's people who prefer to stay in their own homes. They don't interact that much. So the way you can only get them is if you send them pamphlets and things, and hopefully that they'll read those. But the other part of it is even within the scientific community itself, the sharing of information is quite a big challenge. People want to keep what they've got to themselves because there's a notion of intellectual property. It's true. In some cases, there is there. But where the line gets drawn on what is supposed to be public access and not, it gets to be quite difficult. There are policies in place now for free to information and things like that, but people still do not know this. In school levels, in some of the areas we're in, we don't have computers. So even when you say, oh, yeah, I'll give you GIS data that you can use, it's useless. You give them a CD, what do they do with it? Because there's not even a single computer in the schools. The teachers do not know how to use computers themselves. But also even with internet, there's so much information in the internet. But you look at places like Africa, bandwidth is not there.
Yes.
Some of these places, they don't even know such a thing as an internet or how they would ever use it. So how you get information to different groups within the community is the first step on information dissemination, because that's when you actually decide what type of media are you going to use. Radios, in some cases, works quite well because most communities have radio stations. So disseminating it that way works. TV works. One of the sessions I was just in, because they were looking on education and training, those were some of the issues that came up. I just heard today, I didn't know that people could actually use iPods now. And I actually saw a new thing that you've got podcasts.
Yes.
In the government level on information and dissemination, the challenge is of a different nature. It's people not wanting to learn what other departments are doing. They're not being interested or trying to get the information that we have as scientists or as community people working with communities to the decision makers. There's a different media on how you transfer it. You educate them in the way, or you give them the information. And an example is last week I was in a meeting for a geocapacity building meeting, and we have a document that we would like to present to the ministers. The document makes sense to the people who wrote the document. I read it as a decision maker, and I thought, I don't see why I should bother going to the second page. The first page doesn't make me interested to go to the second page. It's too technical. So the bridge, and I think it's the biggest gap we've got at the moment, the bridge between our scientific or technical understanding of the subjects that we're trying to deal with and where the communities are or the groups we trying to get to with the information. Bridging that gap, I think, is the biggest challenge we have at the moment.
Those are some very large gaps that I think are clearly cross-cutting issues in all areas. I understand that you're also working with the Gender Disaster Network. Can you speak to that a little bit?
My connection with the Gender Disaster Network is quite new, because I've been more involved in the scientific side of understanding disasters and geohazards. But my interest in educating people, well, more like in the capacity building, has started to build up in the past 2 years or so. So when this conference came up, and Rowena, my colleague, is part of the Gender Disaster Network, if I was interested to come, and
of course
I was interested to come, because I thought actually getting to hear how other people communicate the information.
Well, in speaking about geoinformation systems, I think it's something that maybe is not well understood by a general audience. What are some of your ideas for future implementation using the data? And I understand you're working in modeling. Maybe you have some ideas for how we can be implementing to lower the risk of disaster.
Well, the project you're mentioning on modeling now is work that we're doing for the Department of Water Affairs in South Africa. They're looking at water resources, because one of the main issues that South Africa has is water. It's getting less and less and less, and the populations are growing. And in the big cities, it's even a major disaster, because people are settling in areas where previously there were recharge zones. So even after the rains, there's not that much water that's actually being captured by aquifers. So one of the backgrounds of our company is groundwater assessment and, well, exploration all the way to resource management. So this particular project is more on the resource management. And it's been quite an interesting one for me to actually see how GIS, how far we could actually take the geoinformation system tool into working with things that actually help the decision makers and therefore improve the community situation. We're using it to calculate things like mean annual precipitation runoffs, looking at how much water there actually is within the aquifers. So the steps that move from there start mapping your geology, the geology of your area, finding information from the weather services on how much rain do you have in the area, weather stations, and modeling that data together. And having decision tools along the way that says, if this is a scenario we have, and this is also the scenario we have, then this is what we can assume to be the case. But in between the things that get done in the GIS system, there's of course the expect intervention, because knowing the area and knowing the geology, so having geologists on the team, having hydrogeologists on the team, and at the end also having engineers on the team helps. So as much as GIS on its own can produce lots of the data, the information, but it only becomes real information once the experts apply some knowledge into that, and then at the end you've got knowledge. So
can you tell me about some of the collaboration on that project? Are you working with other organizations, working with governments or local authorities?
Well, the main local authority working with is the Department of Water Affairs, which is the main body that's looking at water issues in South Africa. Aim of this project actually is to assist the department with water allocations, because in the Western Cape, for example, where we're doing this project for, it's actually done all over the country, but our part is for the Western Cape area. We've got lots of citrus fruit farmers. There's communities, and there's also business people, and there's lots of land development. Golf courses all over the place. We're next to the coast, so golf courses, they want to open all over the place, but they need lots of water. And from the dams, the engineers are also part of the team as well. From the dams that we've got, it's been agreed that there's not enough water in Cape Town. 2 years ago, 2 years in a row, we've had water restrictions because the rains were not enough, yes, and the dams are getting low. So between the hydrogeologists, the geologists, and the engineers, which are the technical experts, it's all different companies. There's also the environmental side that normally gets brought into this, because in the mountains, which is where the groundwater is, there's all sorts of ecosystems that need to be protected. So the environmentalists come in to make sure that we don't get to be drilling in areas where. So the collaboration between the different scientific groups on its own, at the end, also leads to the stakeholders themselves, because people want to know what the government is doing or what the scientists are doing. With groundwater, the main issue that normally comes up is, if you drill here, won't you be taking my water?
Yes.
So farmers are really, really worried about this. So the information has to be given to them from the beginning that this is the project we're wanting to do. So part of this project is normally the stakeholder involvement and educating the community, because firstly, none of us, even us scientists, can say how much water there actually is. We can't see it. It's underground. So we can only assume based on previous studies how it stays there. So when the farmers argue that, well, if you drill here, you'll be taking my water, you actually have to transform the scientific understanding we've got on how the aquifers are linked into something that they could also understand. Now, the Department of Water Affairs normally works with universities as well to try and build up capacity. So part of the projects are done as part of honors or master's program for the students. As the technical team, we supervise the technical part, and then the university take care of all the administration part.
And just to go back to the role and importance of GIS in disaster risk reduction, are there any programs, any networks, any groups that you would like to refer our listeners to where they can get more information or learn more or get involved?
What makes GIS and Earth Observation so powerful is that regardless of, I know the provincial government of the Western Cape, we did a project for them, but we were more looking on the earthquakes, not how they're actually working within the city itself. They've built a GIS system, but it's not yet available to the public to see. But they're mainly using it as to help with the decision, like knowing if someone calls the 911 in the US, but in South Africa it's 10111. If someone calls that, their call automatically gets plotted in a map so that the people in the call center can see where they're calling from. And in that map, it shows which ambulances are in the area and which ambulances are actually available. And then it calculates the distance automatically. And the ambulance that's closest gets the call that they must go check that. And the same happens with the police cars and things like that. But that's not available for the general public to see, but it's a decision-making tool.
And it's an excellent example of application. Is there anything else you would like to share with us today for Prevention Web?
I'm involved with the Group on Earth Observation, GEO. This is Group on Earth Observation, and the idea behind it is to have a Group on Earth Observation system of systems. We call it GEOs. It's an Earth Observation portal. So GEO is working as a facilitator. I'm in the Committee for Capacity Building. It's mainly built on political level, because it has to have a political buy-in. At the moment, I think GEO has about 168 countries that have signed in. But the whole idea that the capacity building community is trying to do is to bridge the gap between the people in focusing on infrastructure and the people just focusing on the implementation and saying, actually, we have to meet somewhere in the middle where both our parts benefit from the
program. Thank you, Andresa. It was nice speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this edition of People in Disaster Risk Reduction. I'm Sarah Wade-Hutman for Prevention Web, Building the Resilience of Nations and Communities to Disasters. Remember, if you have someone you would like to recommend for an interview, you can simply contact us. Click Contact Us from the top right of the PreventionWeb.net homepage. Thanks for listening.